Thank you very much, Graham. And our next speaker, as I mentioned, is Jonathan Hunyor, the Director of our Legal Section. Before joining the Commission in 2002, Jonathan worked as a lawyer with the Central Land Council in Alice Springs. He did that in 2001, and from 1997 to 2000, he was a solicitor with the Northern Territory Legal Aid Commission in Darwin, working primarily in the fields of criminal and refugee law. Jonathan teaches discrimination law at the University of New South Wales and has publishes regularly on human rights law generally. This evening, Jonathan is going to provide an overview of the changes to federal disability discrimination laws which came into effect on 5 August of this year. Let's welcome Jonathan.
Thanks very much, Cathy. Cathy's taken care of the introductions, and Graham has taken us all to the disco, so I guess my role is really to make sure that everyone gets home safely. The nature of what I'm going to talk about is somewhat technical, and so I hope it won't also be somewhat boring, and that, to continue the analogy, we won't all fall asleep on the bus and wake up past our stop. But what I'm going to try to do tonight is highlight some of the significant changes that have been made to the DDA by the Disability Discrimination and Other Human Rights Legislation Amendment Act. The focus of my presentation is on the changes to the DDA that commenced on the 5th of August, but there are some other changes that have been made in that legislation, and some of those are set out in the written paper that I've prepared and that's available tonight. The main impetus for the changes to the DDA was the 2004 review of the DDA that was conducted by the Australian Productivity Commission, and which recommended a range of changes to improve the operation of the DDA. And for the reasons I'll come to, I think that goal has largely been met, but I think there are probably some complexities and dangers lying within the changes that have been made. Tonight I'm going to just focus on 3 changes that have been made to the DDA. Firstly, changes to the principal definition of indirect discrimination. Second, what is described as a positive duty to make reasonable adjustments. And third, the changes that have been made to clarify the rights and obligations relating to assistance animals under the DDA. I'll just flag the other changes that are in the paper, and I should say the hard copy of the paper is available tonight, but an electronic version will be available on our website along with an audio recording of the presentations. The other changes that are covered in the paper include the recognition of the Disabilities Convention, or DISCO, as a constitutional basis for the DDA, changes to the definition of disability to clarify that it includes genetic predispositions and behavioural manifestations of disability, making the inherent requirements defence available to employers in a wider range of circumstances, making the defence of unjustifiable hardship available in all areas of public life covered by the DDA, and also modifying the prohibition on requests for information relating to disability. So the first thing I'd like to look at are changes to the principal definition of indirect discrimination. Most of you will be familiar with the concept of indirect discrimination, and unfortunately for people with a disability, both the concept and its impact are familiar. Indirect discrimination is sometimes also called disparate impact discrimination, and occurs when an apparently neutral requirement or condition is imposed which has a disparate impact upon a particular group of people. An obvious example that's arisen in cases under the DDA is access to premises. Where premises allow for access only via a set of stairs, this is an apparently neutral requirement that you enter the building via those stairs. But this obviously has a disparate impact upon people with mobility disabilities, such as those using a wheelchair, and so it may constitute indirect discrimination. Now, this all may seem simple enough, but then comes the DDA, which inevitably is rather more complex, and I'm afraid there's no poetry to be found there. The DDA, as amended, in essence requires an aggrieved person to show 3 things. First, that another person, the discriminator, requires or proposes to require them to comply with a requirement or condition. Second, that because of their disability, the aggrieved person is not able to comply with that requirement or condition, and third, that the requirement or condition has or is likely to have the effect of disadvantaging persons with the disability. Now, this new definition includes a number of significant changes from the previous definition of indirect discrimination, and I'll try to just sketch those for you in general terms. The first is that the definition of indirect discrimination has now been extended to explicitly include proposed acts of indirect discrimination. It's therefore no longer necessary for an aggrieved person to show that a condition or requirement has actually been imposed. Second, the section has removed the so-called proportionality requirement. This required an applicant to prove that, I quote, a substantially higher proportion of persons without the disability comply or are able to comply with the relevant requirement or condition. The Productivity Commission, in its review, concluded that there was little benefit in having this requirement, and it was simply another hoop through which a complainant needed to jump, and so fortunately it's now been done away with. However, it's still necessary for an applicant to show that they cannot comply with the requirement or condition. They must also now show that their inability to comply is because of the disability, so these words, because of the disability, have now been added. I think this change is unlikely to have any practical effect, although, having said that, I suspect that the first case to come down will prove me wrong. But applicants have typically challenged requirements or conditions that they say have a disparate impact upon them because of their disability and not for any other reason. So, as I say, I wouldn't be surprised if this change has no particular effect. But it is disappointing that an applicant is still required to prove an inability to comply with the requirement or condition. This has been a fraught issue for complainants. Courts have held in a number of cases that the relevant test is whether a person will face a serious disadvantage in complying with the relevant requirement or condition. The implication that people with disability should necessarily be expected to bear some degree of disadvantage is, in my view, not consistent with achieving equality. To give an example, and it's one that I'll come back to later in the paper as well, so I'll sketch it in some detail. An example is the case of Hinchliffe and the University of New South Wales. In that matter, a university student was provided with course materials which were in an inaccessible format. And I expect that many of you will be familiar with this case. Ms. Hinchliffe's disability, oculocutaneous albinism, meant that she was unable to read material in small font on white paper because it caused her fatigue. Ms. Hinchliffe sought to have her course materials provided in alternative formats, such as natural voice audio tapes or printed in 24-point Arial font on light green paper. The university, however, provided the materials only in a single standard format. This required Ms. Hinchliffe and her mother, who helped her, to reformat the material to be able to read it. The university did provide her with a disability services room, which contained computers, a photocopier, a scanner, and a stock of green paper, but it was for Ms. Hinchliffe to do the reformatting. And her evidence was that requiring her to reformat her own material was very time-consuming and meant that she had less time to study as well as less time to enjoy other aspects of student life, possibly going to the disco. The court found that the need to reformat material probably inconvenienced her relative to students who did not suffer from her disability, but she was able to comply with the requirement to use material provided in a standard format. Federal Magistrate Raphael further held that while some of the material she was not able to reformat, this was reasonable in the circumstances because there was a disability services officer who was provided by the university who could help her deal with those issues. And so Ms. Hinchcliffe's claim was unsuccessful. Returning to the changes to the definition of indirect discrimination, the section now also requires that an application prove that the requirement or condition has or is likely to have the effect of disadvantaging persons with the disability. The term disadvantaging isn't defined in the DDA, and the explanatory memorandum, somewhat unhelpfully, states only that in order for there to be discrimination, there must be a differential impact. Two particular issues would seem to arise in terms of this issue of disadvantage. The first is defining the group of people with the disability of the aggrieved person, and the second is the need to The first is the need to define the group of people with the disability of the aggrieved person. I think here the need to identify the relevant disability with some precision is going to be particularly important. This will not necessarily be a problem for applicants, as usually it is the case that they're able to and do precisely identify their disability, but it's worth noting that a broad definition of a person's disability may make proof of this element more difficult. It may require an aggrieved person to show that persons with a similar but less acute disability are also disadvantaged by the requirement or condition. Returning to the example of Hinchliffe, her disability was defined quite specifically as oculocutaneous albinism. If, however, her disability was defined more broadly as a vision impairment, she may not necessarily have been able to persuade the court that people with such a disability, which for many can be remedied by using glasses, were necessarily disadvantaged by the requirement or condition. The second issue here, when considering disadvantage to persons with a disability, I think will be what evidence is needed to prove that a requirement or condition has or is likely to have the effect of disadvantaging people with a disability. And I think it's likely to vary, perhaps obviously, from case to case. It may be that courts are prepared to take judicial notice of the disadvantage caused by a requirement or condition, or to simply apply their common sense. In the context of the Sex Discrimination Act, for example, it's been successfully argued that the requirement to work full-time is a condition, requirement or practice that has the effect of disadvantaging women, and courts have accepted generally as a matter of judicial notice without any specific evidence that this disadvantage stems from the fact that women are more likely to require part-time work to meet their family responsibilities. There are also indications of a similar approach in decisions under the pre-2009 indirect discrimination provisions of the DDA concerning the proportionality requirement, and I've set some of those out in the paper, but it's clear that it will depend on the nature of the case. And for example, in Penhall Jones and the State of New South Wales, the court stated that there are occasions where one can take the evidence of one complainant as being typical of all members of the group. One person in a wheelchair who complained that she was unable to climb the stairs to the Opera House might be accepted as speaking for all persons in her position. So I think we might hope that courts will take a similar approach. The last significant change to the definition of indirect discrimination that I want to note is the shift in the burden of proof that a requirement or condition is reasonable. This burden now lies on the respondent. This brings the DDA finally into line with the approach to indirect discrimination that is taken under both the Sex Discrimination Act and the Age Discrimination Act. The second issue that I wanted to look at this evening is introducing a duty to make reasonable adjustments. This is perhaps the most significant of the changes made by the 2009 amendments. Introducing a positive duty to make reasonable adjustments was one of the recommendations of the Productivity Commission's review and is consistent with the requirement to make reasonable accommodation in the Disabilities Convention. The explanatory memorandum to the amending legislation says this: until relatively recently, the general view, including in the case law, was that the Disability Discrimination Act impliedly imposes such a duty if such adjustments are necessary to avoid unlawful discrimination, subject to the defence of unjustifiable hardship. However, as many of us know, the majority of the High Court in Purvis and New South Wales considered the direct discrimination provisions of the DDA and rejected any suggestion that they imposed an obligation to provide reasonable adjustment. Any obligation could therefore only arise through the operation of the indirect discrimination provisions. And so the 2009 amendments are said to make explicit the positive duty to make reasonable adjustments. It should be noted, however, that despite the claim that there is now a positive duty in the DDA really provides a cause of action for a failure to make a reasonable adjustment. There isn't a proactive obligation on service providers, educational authorities or government agencies in these provisions to ensure that existing structural features that may disadvantage people with disability are removed or altered. The duty is embedded into the definitions of both direct and indirect discrimination. I should note that there is an existing requirement to make reasonable adjustments in the education standards of 2005, but that's not something I'm going to take you to this evening. The first issue then is, what are reasonable adjustments? And reasonable adjustments are defined as all adjustments that do not impose an unjustifiable hardship upon the person making the adjustments. The burden of proving unjustifiable hardship under Section 11 of the DDA lies on the person claiming it. And in practice, therefore, it seems that it will be initially for the aggrieved person to identify the relevant adjustment or adjustments, and it's for the person who is refusing or failing to make those to demonstrate that if they were to make those, it would impose an unjustifiable hardship upon them. The definition of direct discrimination has now been amended to introduce a duty as follows, and I must apologise for taking you to the legislation. As I say, there's not much poetry in it, but unfortunately its terms need to be examined reasonably closely. So Section 5.2 now says that for the purposes of this Act, a person, the discriminator, also discriminates against another person, the aggrieved person, on the ground of a disability of the aggrieved person if, A, the discriminator does not make or proposes not to make reasonable adjustments for the person, and B, the failure to make the reasonable adjustments has or would have the effect that the aggrieved person is, because of the disability, treated less favourably than a person without the disability would be treated in circumstances that are not materially different. And if you think that's a mouthful, wait till we get to indirect discrimination. To break this down, this would seem to operate as follows. Firstly, the aggrieved person identifies the adjustment or adjustments. Second, the respondent must refuse or fail to make those adjustments. Third, the respondent may argue that the adjustments are not reasonable because they impose an unjustifiable hardship. And then, if we move on through those stages and the adjustments are found to be reasonable, the aggrieved person must show that the failure to make the adjustments has the effect that they are treated less favourably than a person without the disability in basically the same circumstances, and that less favourable treatment is because of the aggrieved person's disability. Now, the causal link here between the disability and the less favourable treatment that comes from those words because of should not, in my view, be understood as requiring proof of any intentional motive to discriminate or disadvantage. That's clearly the law in relation to Section 5 to date, and I think it has to be clearly the case here. What this section appears to require is that the effect of the failure to make reasonable accommodation, i.e. the less favourable treatment, can be linked to a person's disability rather than to some other factor. I'm not sure, as I said, in relation to indirect discrimination, whether this because of will in practice have much of an impact, because generally people are only complaining because the link is between their inability to do something because of the requirement or condition or the failure to make reasonable adjustments and their disability. But it is a part of the definition that attention will need to be paid to. So how would this duty to make reasonable adjustments apply in Ms. Hinchliffe's situation? The reasonable adjustment in that case is the provision of course materials in a particular format, i.e. either audio or an enlarged font on green paper. So the university refused to provide material in those formats, and they didn't in that case argue an unjustifiable hardship. So the adjustment would, by definition, be a reasonable one. Ms. Hinchliffe would then be required to show that the effect of the failure to make adjustments is that she is treated less favourably than a person without the disability in the same circumstances. Arguably, in her case, the effect is that she's either required to study without the materials or spend her own time reformatting the materials, denying her time to study and participate in university life. And I think it could be argued reasonably straightforward way that that's less favourable treatment. Another student doing the course would obviously not be in that position. The less favourable treatment is because of Ms. Hinchliffe's disability, and the real reason, and this follows because the real reason she has to either study without the materials or spend time reformatting the material is because she has a disability that makes the material otherwise inaccessible to her. So I think it's possible to argue that in Ms. Hinchliffe's case, which failed under the former indirect discrimination provisions, that she may have succeeded under the new direct discrimination provisions that create this duty to make reasonable adjustment. The second way in which the duty to make reasonable adjustment is introduced is by inserting it into the definition of indirect discrimination, and I'm afraid this is where it becomes even more complicated. As if the definition for indirect discrimination wasn't complicated enough, Section 6.2 provides that for the purposes of this Act, a person, the discriminator, also discriminates against another person, the aggrieved person, on the ground of a disability of the aggrieved person if A, the discriminator requires or proposes to require the aggrieved person to comply with a requirement or condition, and B, because of the disability, the aggrieved person would comply or would be able to comply with the requirement or condition only if the discriminator made reasonable adjustments for the person, but the discriminator does not do so or proposes not to do so, and C, the failure to make reasonable adjustments has or is likely to have the effect of disadvantaging persons with the disability. I should also note that Section 6 subsection 3 provides that if the requirement or condition is shown to be reasonable, then this provision doesn't apply at all. So the section would seem to operate as follows. First, the aggrieved person identifies a requirement or condition, and then identifies the reasonable adjustments, and then must be able to prove that because of their disability, they can comply with the requirement or condition only with the reasonable adjustments. Then the respondent refuses or fails to make the adjustments. The respondent may argue the unjustifiable hardship point. If the adjustments are reasonable, the aggrieved person must show that the failure to make the adjustments has or is likely to have the effect of disadvantaging persons with the disability. And in any event, if the respondent can show the requirement or condition is reasonable, then the duty doesn't apply. So how would Ms. Hinchliffe fare under this definition? I suspect that she would face the same problem that she did in her original claim. Namely, she wouldn't be able to show, in my view, that she could comply with the requirement or condition only if the university made the relevant reasonable adjustment. This is because the court found that she could also comply if she and her mother put themselves to some disadvantage. And to the extent that she couldn't comply, the requirement that she deal with the material in the standard form was found to be reasonable in any event. And so, the requirement or condition being reasonable won't fall within the section at all. So it may be that Section 6.2 is actually less useful as a means of implementing the duty to make reasonable accommodation than the simpler form of the duty contained in Section 5.2, the direct provision. And particularly significant here is the fact, I think, that under the direct provision, only unjustifiable hardship is available to a respondent to avoid the duty applying, subject, of course, to any other exemption that may apply. Under the indirect version of the same duty, a respondent can argue unjustifiable hardship, but can also argue that the requirement or condition is reasonable in any event. This result, I must say, came as somewhat of a surprise to me. After Purvis, I think we'd all put our eggs in the indirect discrimination basket and assumed that if you were going to get up, it was only going to be under Section 6. But I think we'll have to wait and see what the courts make of it, because, as I've said, I think there could be, because of the complexity in the indirect discrimination provisions, I think they may be harder to make out. Finally, I'd like to just briefly touch on the changes relating to assistance animals. The 2009 amendments have sought to clarify the law following the decision of the full federal court in Queensland and Forest. And again, some of you will be familiar with the facts of that case. Mr. Forrest alleged that he was discriminated against by Queensland Health because he was not allowed to take either of his dogs in to certain hospital premises. He'd trained his dogs to alleviate his psychiatric disability and claimed that this was discrimination against him. Justices Emmett and Spender found that it was not enough for the applicant to show that he had been treated less favourably because he was accompanied by an assistance animal under the then Section 9 of the DDA, it was also necessary to show that he had been discriminated against on the ground of his disability. The reason for this turned upon the particular wording of the DDA, and I won't drag you through those highlights of statutory interpretation, but suffice to say, in Mr. Forrest's case, Queensland Health treated him less favourably because of the fact he was accompanied by his dogs, but not on the ground of his psychiatric disability, and so he was unsuccessful. This approach clearly left very little work, if any, for Section 9 to do. There was little point in going to the trouble of proving that you've been discriminated against because you're accompanied by an assistance animal if you also had to prove discrimination on the ground of your disability. Section 8 now makes it clear that discrimination on the ground of having an assistance animal, or I should note, a carer, assistant or a disability aide, is to be treated as discrimination on the ground of disability. It's not necessary to separately prove that the discrimination occurs on the ground of disability. The Forrest case also raised concerns about the impact of the assistance animal's provisions on respondents who may need to consider issues of health and safety, particularly in the context of dogs that hadn't been formally trained or accredited. In Mr. Forrest's case, he had trained his dogs Buddy and Knuckles himself. Queensland Health refused Mr. Forrest access to its premises because they said of concerns about the behaviour and control of his dogs and the absence of evidence that they had been properly trained. The 2009 amendments are said to provide certainty for both people with assistance animals and service providers by clarifying the entitlements and obligations of both parties. And I'll just note a few features of the new Section 54 capital A, which provides a range of exemptions. In particular, that section provides that it's not unlawful to request or require that an assistance animal remain under control. It's not unlawful for a person to discriminate against a person with a disability on the ground of the disability if they reasonably suspect that the assistance animal has an infectious disease and the discrimination is reasonably necessary to protect public health or the health of other animals. It's not unlawful for a person to request the person with the disability to produce evidence that the animal is an assistance animal or is trained to meet standards of hygiene and behaviour that are appropriate in a public place. It's not unlawful for a person to discriminate on the ground that a person has an assistance animal if the person with the assistance animal fails to produce evidence the animal is an assistance animal or is trained to meet the standards of hygiene and behaviour that are appropriate for an animal in a public place. That concludes my presentation for this evening, and in conclusion, I think it's clear that the 2009 amendments are intended overwhelmingly to provide better protection against discrimination for people with disability. There are a number of challenging issues that they raise, not least of all in some of their complexities, but I think it's to be hoped by all that the courts will apply them with their remedial purpose clearly in mind. Thank you.